decision-making on this idea. All you have to do is mitigate the consequences. As I said, if my portfolio is exposed to a market crash, the odds of which I can't compute, all I have to do is buy insurance or get out and invest the amounts I am not willing to ever lose in less risky securities. Effectively, if free markets have been successful, it is precisely because they allow the trial-and-error process I call stochastic tinkering on the part of competing individual operators who fall for the narrative fallacy, but are effectively, collectively partaking of a grand project. We are increasingly learning to practice stochastic tinkering without knowing it, thanks to overconfident entrepreneurs, naive investors, greedy investment bankers, and aggressive venture capitalists brought together by the free market system. The next chapter shows why I am optimistic that the Academy is losing its power and ability to put knowledge in straitjackets, and that more out-of-the-box knowledge will be generated wiki-style. In the end, we are being driven by history, all the while thinking that we are doing the driving. I'll sum up this long section on prediction by stating that we can easily narrow down the reasons we can't figure out what's going on. There are A. epistemic arrogance and our corresponding future blindness. B. the Platonic notion of categories, or how people are fooled by reductions, particularly if they have an academic degree in an expert-free discipline. And finally, C. flawed tools of inference, particularly the black swan-free tools from Mediocristan. In the next section, we will go deeper, much deeper, into these tools from Mediocristan, into the plumbing, so to speak. Some listeners may see it as an appendix. Others may consider it the heart of the book. Part 3. Those Gray Swans of Extremistan. It's time to deal in some depth with four final items that bear on our black swan. Primo, I have said earlier that the world is moving deeper into Extremistan, that it is less and less governed by Mediocristan. In fact, this idea is more subtle than that. I will show how and present the various ideas we have about the formation of inequality. Secundo, I have been describing the Gaussian bell curve as a contagious and severe delusion, and it is time to get into that point in some depth. Terzo, I will present what I call Mandelbrotian or fractal randomness. Remember that for an event to be a black swan, it does not just have to be rare or just wild. It has to be unexpected, has to lie outside our tunnel of possibilities. You must be a sucker for it. As it happens, many rare events can yield their structure to us. It is not easy to compute their probability, but it is easy to get a general idea about the possibility of their occurrence. We can turn these black swans into gray swans, so to speak, reducing their surprise effect. A person aware of the possibility of such events can come to belong to the non-sucker variety. Finally, I will present the ideas of those philosophers who focus on phony uncertainty. I organized this book in such a way that the more technical, though non-essential, sections are here. These can be skipped without any loss to the thoughtful listener, particularly chapters 15, 17, and the second half of chapter 16. I will alert the listener with footnotes. The listener less interested in the mechanics of deviations can then directly proceed to part 4. Chapter 14. From Mediocristan to Extremistan and Back. I prefer Horowitz. How to Fall from Favor. The Long Tail. Get ready for some surprises. It's not just money. Let us see how an increasingly man-made planet can evolve away from mild into wild randomness. First, I describe how we get to Extremistan. Then, I will take a look at its evolution. The world is unfair. Is the world that unfair? I have spent my entire life studying randomness, practicing randomness, hating randomness. The more the time passes, the worse things seem to me, the more scared I get, the more disgusted I am with Mother Nature. The more I think about my subject, the more I see evidence that the world we have in our minds is different from the one playing outside. Every morning, the world appears to me more random than it did the day before, and humans seem to be even more fooled by it than they were the previous day. It is becoming unbearable. I find writing these lines painful. I find the world revolting. Two soft scientists propose intuitive models for the development of this inequity. One is a mainstream economist, the other a sociologist. Both simplify a little too much. I will present their ideas because they are easy to understand, not because of the scientific quality of their insights or any consequences in their discoveries. Then I will show the story as seen from the vantage point of the natural scientists. Let me start with the economist, Sherwin Rosen. In the early 80s, he wrote papers about the economics of superstars. In one of the papers, he conveyed his sense of outrage that a basketball player could earn $1.2 million a year, or a television celebrity could make $2 million. To get an idea of how this concentration is increasing, i.e., of how we are moving away from mediocristan, consider that television celebrities and sports stars, even in Europe, get contracts today, only two decades later, worth in the hundreds of millions of dollars. The extreme is about, so far, 20 times higher than it was two decades ago. According to Rosen, this inequality comes from a tournament effect. Someone who is marginally better can easily win the entire pot, leaving the others with nothing. Using an argument from Chapter 3, people prefer to pay $10.99 for a recording featuring Horowitz to $9.99 for a struggling pianist. Would you rather read Kundera for $13.99 or some unknown author for $1? So it looks like a tournament where the winner grabs the whole thing, and he does not have to win by much. But the role of luck is missing in Rosen's beautiful argument. The problem here is the notion of better, this focus on skills as leading to success. Random outcomes, or an arbitrary situation, can also explain success, and provide the initial push that leads to a winner-take-all result. A person can get slightly ahead for entirely random reasons. Because we like to imitate one another, we will flock to him. The world of contagion is so underestimated. As I am writing these lines, I am using a Macintosh by Apple, after years of using Microsoft-based products. The Apple technology is vastly better, yet the inferior software won the day. How? Luck. The Matthew Effect. More than a decade before Rosen, the sociologist of science Robert K. Merton presented his idea of the Matthew Effect, by which people take from the poor to give to the rich. Footnote. These scalable laws were already discussed in the scriptures. For unto everyone that hath shall be given, and he shall have abundance. But from him that hath not shall be taken away even that which he hath. Matthew. Matthew chapter 25, verse 29, King James Version. He looked at the performance of scientists and showed how an initial advantage follows someone through life. Consider the following process. Let's say someone writes an academic paper quoting 50 people who have worked on the subject and provided background materials for his study. Assume, for the sake of simplicity, that all 50 are of equal merit. Another researcher working on the exact same subject will randomly cite 3 of those 50 in his bibliography. Merton showed that many academics cite references without having read the original work. Rather, they'll read a paper and draw their own citations from among its sources. So a third researcher reading the second article selects 3 of the previously referenced authors for his citations. These 3 authors will receive cumulatively more and more attention as their names become associated more tightly with the subject at hand. The difference between the winning 3 and the other members of the original cohort is mostly luck. They were initially chosen not for their greater skill, but simply for the way their names appeared in the prior bibliography. Thanks to their reputations, these successful academics will go on writing papers, and their work will be easily accepted for publication. Academic success is partly, but significantly, a lottery. Footnote. Much of the perception of the importance of precocity in the career of researchers can be owed to the misunderstanding of the perverse role of this effect, especially when reinforced by bias. Enough counterexamples, even in fields like mathematics, meant to be purely a young man's game, illustrate the age fallacy. Simply, it is necessary to be successful early, and even very early at that. It is easy to test the effect of reputation. One way would be to find papers that were written by famous scientists, had their authors' identities changed by mistake, and got rejected. You could verify how many of these rejections were subsequently overturned after the true identities of the authors were established. Note that scholars are judged mostly on how many times their work is referenced in other people's work, and thus cliques of people who quote one another are formed. It's an I quote you, you quote me type of business. Eventually, authors who are not often cited will drop out of the game by, say, going to work for the government, if they are of a gentle nature, or for the mafia, or for a Wall Street firm, if they have a high level of hormones. Those who got a good push in the beginning of their scholarly careers will keep getting persistent cumulative advantages throughout life. It is easier for the rich to get richer, for the famous to become more famous. In sociology, Matthew effects bear the less literary name cumulative advantage. This theory can easily apply to companies, businessmen, actors, writers, and anyone else who benefits from past success. If you get published in the New Yorker because the color of your letterhead attracted the attention of the editor who was daydreaming of daisies, the resultant reward can follow you for life. More significantly, it will follow others for life. Failure is also cumulative. Losers are likely to also lose in the future, even if we don't take into account the mechanism of demoralization that might exacerbate it and cause additional failure. Note that art, because of its dependence on word of mouth, is extremely prone to these cumulative advantage effects. I mentioned clustering in Chapter 1 and how journalism helps perpetuate these clusters. Our opinions about artistic merit are the result of arbitrary contagion even more than our political ideas are. One person writes a book review. Another person reads it and writes a commentary that uses the same arguments. Soon you have several hundred reviews that actually sum up in their contents to no more than two or three because there is so much overlap. For an anecdotal example, read Fire the Bastards, whose author, Jack Green, goes systematically through the reviews of William Gaddis's novel, The Recognitions. Green shows clearly how book reviewers anchor on other reviews and reveals powerful mutual influence, even in their wording. This phenomenon is reminiscent of the herding of financial analysts I discussed in Chapter 10. The advent of the modern media has accelerated these cumulative advantages. The sociologist Pierre Bourdieu noted a link between the increased concentration of success and the globalization of culture and economic life. But I am not trying to play sociologist here, only show that unpredictable elements can play a role in social outcomes. Merton's cumulative advantage idea has a more general precursor, preferential attachment, which, reversing the chronology, though not the logic, I will present next. Merton was interested in the social aspect of knowledge, not in the dynamics of social randomness, so his studies were derived separately from research on the dynamics of randomness in more mathematical sciences. Lingua franca. The theory of preferential attachment is ubiquitous in its applications. It can explain why city size is from extremistan, why vocabulary is concentrated among a small number of words, or why bacteria populations can vary hugely in size. The scientists J.C. Willis and G.U. Yule published a landmark paper in Nature in 1922 called Some Statistics of Evolution and Geographical Distribution in Plants and Animals and Their Significance. Willis and Yule noted the presence in biology of the so-called power laws, attractable versions of the scalable randomness that I discussed in Chapter 3. These power laws, on which more technical information in the following chapters, had been noticed earlier by Vilfredo Pareto, who found that they applied to the distribution of income. Later, Yule presented a simple model showing how power laws can be generated. His point was as follows. Let's say species split in two at some constant rate, so that new species arise. The richer in species a genus is, the richer it will tend to get, with the same logic as the Matthew effect. Note the following caveat. In Yule's model, the species never die out. During the 1940s, a Harvard linguist, George Zipf, examined the properties of language and came up with an empirical regularity now known as Zipf's law, which, of course, is not a law, and if it were, it would not be Zipf's. It is just another way to think about the process of inequality. The mechanisms he described were as follows. The more you use a word, the less effortful you will find it to use that word again. So you borrow words from your private dictionary in proportion to their past use. This explains why out of the 60,000 main words in English, only a few hundred constitute the bulk of what is used in writings, and even fewer appear regularly in conversation. Likewise, the more people aggregate in a particular city, the more likely a stranger will be to pick that city as his destination. The big get bigger and the small stay small, or get relatively smaller. A great illustration of preferential attachment can be seen in the mushrooming use of English as a lingua franca, though not for its intrinsic qualities, but because people need to use one single language, or stick to one as much as possible, when they are having a conversation. So whatever language appears to have the upper hand will suddenly draw people in droves. Its usage will spread like an epidemic, and other languages will be rapidly dislodged. I am often amazed to listen to conversations between people from two neighboring countries, say, between a Turk and an Iranian, or a Lebanese and a Cypriot, communicating in bad English, moving their hands for emphasis, searching for these words that come out of their throats at the cost of great physical effort. Even members of the Swiss Army use English, not French, as a lingua franca. It would be fun to listen. Consider that a very small minority of Americans of Northern European descent is from England. Traditionally, the preponderant ethnic groups are of German, Irish, Dutch, French, and other Northern European extraction. Yet because all these groups now use English as their main tongue, they have to study the roots of their adoptive tongue and develop a cultural association with parts of a particular wet island, along with its history, its traditions, and its customs. Ideas and contagions. The same model can be used for the contagions and concentration of ideas. But there are some restrictions on the nature of epidemics I must discuss here. Ideas do not spread without some form of structure. Recall the discussion in Chapter 4 about how we come prepared to make inferences. Just as we tend to generalize some matters but not others, so there seem to be basins of attraction directing us to certain beliefs. Some ideas will prove contagious, but not others. Some forms of superstitions will spread, but not others. Some types of religious beliefs will dominate, but not others. The anthropologist, cognitive scientist, and philosopher Dan Sperber has proposed the following idea on the epidemiology of representations. What people call memes, ideas that spread and that compete with one another using people as carriers, are not truly like genes. Ideas spread because, alas, they have for carriers self-serving agents who are interested in them, and interested in distorting them in the replication process. You do not make a cake for the sake of merely replicating a recipe. You try to make your own cake, using ideas from others to improve it. We humans are not photocopiers. So contagious mental categories must be those in which we are prepared to believe, perhaps even programmed to believe. To be contagious, a mental category must agree with our nature. Nobody is safe in Extremistan. There is something extremely naive about all these models of the dynamics of concentration I've presented so far, particularly the socioeconomic ones. For instance, although Merton's idea includes luck, it misses an additional layer of randomness. In all these models, the winner stays a winner. Now, a loser might always remain a loser, but a winner could be unseated by someone new popping up out of nowhere. Nobody is safe. Preferential attachment theories are intuitively appealing, but they do not account for the possibility of being supplanted by newcomers, what every schoolchild knows as the decline of civilizations. Consider the logic of cities. How did Rome, with a population of 1.2 million in the 1st century AD, end up with a population of 12,000 in the 3rd? How did Baltimore, once a principal American city, become a relic? And how did Philadelphia come to be overshadowed by New York? A Brooklyn Frenchman. When I started trading foreign exchange, I befriended a fellow named Vincent who exactly resembled a Brooklyn trader, down to the mannerisms of Fat Tony, except that he spoke the French version of Brooklynese. Vincent taught me a few tricks. Among his sayings were, "Trading may have princes, but nobody stays a king." And, "The people you meet on the way up, you will meet again on the way down." There were theories when I was a child about class warfare and struggles by innocent individuals against powerful monster corporations capable of swallowing the world. Anyone with intellectual hunger was fed these theories, which were inherited from the Marxist belief that the tools of exploitation were self-feeding, that the powerful would grow more and more powerful, furthering the unfairness of the system. But one had only to look around to see that these large corporate monsters dropped like flies. Take a cross-section of the dominant corporations at any particular time. Many of them will be out of business a few decades later, while firms nobody ever heard of will have popped onto the scene from some garage in California or from some college dorm. Consider the following sobering statistic. Of the 500 largest U.S. companies in 1957, only 74 were still part of that select group, the Standard & Poor's 500, 40 years later. Only a few had disappeared in mergers. The rest either shrank or went bust. Interestingly, almost all these large corporations were located in the most capitalist country on Earth, the United States. The more socialist a country's orientation, the easier it was for the large corporate monsters to stick around. Why did capitalism, and not socialism, destroy these ogres? In other words, if you leave companies alone, they tend to get eaten up. Those in favor of economic freedom claim that beastly and greedy corporations pose no threat because competition keeps them in check. What I saw at the Wharton School convinced me that the real reason includes a large share of something else. Chance. But when people discuss chance, which they rarely do, they usually only look at their own luck. The luck of others counts greatly. Another corporation may luck out thanks to a blockbuster product and displace the current winners. Capitalism is, among other things, the revitalization of the world thanks to the opportunity to be lucky. Luck is the grand equalizer, because almost everyone can benefit from it. The socialist governments protected their monsters and, by doing so, killed potential newcomers in the womb. Everything is transitory. Luck both made and unmade Carthage. It both made and unmade Rome. I said earlier that randomness is bad, but it is not always so. Luck is far more egalitarian than even intelligence. If people were rewarded strictly according to their abilities, things would still be unfair. People don't choose their abilities. Randomness has the beneficial effect of reshuffling society's cards, knocking down the big guy. In the arts, fads do the same job. A newcomer may benefit from a fad, as followers multiply thanks to a preferential attachment style epidemic. Then, guess what? He too becomes history. It is quite interesting to look at the acclaimed authors of a particular era and see how many have dropped out of consciousness. It even happens in countries such as France, where the government supports established reputations, just as it supports ailing large companies. When I visit Beirut, I often spot in relatives' homes the remnants of a series of distinctively white leather-bound Nobel books. Some hyperactive salesman once managed to populate private libraries with these beautifully made volumes. Many people buy books for decorative purposes and want a simple selection criterion. The criterion this series offered was one book by a Nobel winner in literature every year, a simple way to build the ultimate library. The series was supposed to be updated every year, but I presume the company went out of business in the 80s. I feel a pang every time I look at these volumes. Do you hear much today about Sully Prudhomme, the first recipient, Pearl Buck, an American woman, Roman Roland, Anatole France? The last two were the most famous French authors of their generations. Saint-Jean Perse, Roger Martin Dugard, or Frédéric Mistral? The Long Tail. I have said that nobody is safe in Extremistan. This has a converse. Nobody is threatened with complete extinction either. Our current environment allows the little guy to bide his time in the antechamber of success. As long as there is life, there is hope. This idea was recently revived by Chris Anderson, one of a very few who get the point that the dynamics of fractal concentration has another layer of randomness. He packaged it with his idea of the long tail, about which in a moment. Anderson is lucky not to be a professional statistician. People who have had the misfortune of going through conventional statistical training think we live in Mediocristan. He was able to take a fresh look at the dynamics of the world. True, the web produces acute concentration. A large number of users visit just a few sites, such as Google, which, at the time of this writing, has total market dominance. At no time in history has a company grown so dominant so quickly. Google can service people from Nicaragua to southwestern Mongolia to the American West Coast without having to worry about phone operators, shipping, delivery, and manufacturing. This is the ultimate winner-take-all case study. People forget, though, that before Google, Alta Vista dominated the search engine market. I am prepared to revise the Google metaphor by replacing it with a new name for future editions of this book. What Anderson saw is that the web causes something in addition to concentration. The web enables the formation of a reservoir of proto-Googles waiting in the background. It also promotes the inverse Google, that is, it allows people with a technical specialty to find a small, stable audience. Recall the role of the web in Yevgenia Krasnova's success. Thanks to the internet, she was able to bypass conventional publishers. Her publisher with the pink glasses would not even have been in business had it not been for the web. Let's assume that Amazon.com does not exist and that you have written a sophisticated book. Odds are that a very small bookstore that carries only 5,000 volumes will not be interested in letting your beautifully crafted prose occupy premium shelf space. And the mega bookstore, such as the average American Barnes & Noble, might stock 130,000 volumes, which is still not sufficient to accommodate marginal titles. So your work is stillborn. Not so with web vendors. A web bookstore can carry a near infinite number of books since it need not have them physically in inventory. Actually, nobody needs to have them physically in inventory since they can remain in digital form until they are needed in print, an emerging business called print on demand. So as the author of this little book, you can sit there, bide your time, be available in search engines, and perhaps benefit from an occasional epidemic. In fact, the quality of readership has improved markedly over the past few years, thanks to the availability of these more sophisticated books. This is a fertile environment for diversity. Footnote: the web's bottom-up feature is also making book reviewers more accountable. While writers were helpless and vulnerable to the arbitrariness of book reviews, which can distort their messages and, thanks to the confirmation bias, expose small, irrelevant weak points in their text, they now have a much stronger hand. In place of the moaning letter to the editor, they can simply post their review of a review on the web. If attacked ad hominem, they can reply ad hominem and go directly after the credibility of the reviewer, making sure that their statement shows rapidly in an internet search or on Wikipedia, the bottom-up encyclopedia. Plenty of people have called me to discuss the idea of the long tail, which seems to be the exact opposite of the concentration implied by scalability. The long tail implies that the small guys, collectively, should control a large segment of culture and commerce, thanks to the niches and subspecialties that can now survive thanks to the internet. But, strangely, it can also imply a large measure of inequality. A large base of small guys and a very small number of supergiants, together representing a share of the world's culture, with some of the small guys, on occasion, rising to knock out the winners. This is the double tail, a large tail of the small guys, a small tail of the big guys. The role of the long tail is fundamental in changing the dynamics of success, destabilizing the well-seated winner, and bringing about another winner. In a snapshot, this will always be Extremistan, always ruled by the concentration of type 2 randomness, but it will be an ever-changing Extremistan. The long tail's contribution is not yet numerical. It is still confined to the web and its small-scale online commerce. But consider how the long tail could affect the future of culture information, and political life. It could free us from the dominant political parties, from the academic system, from the clusters of the press, anything that is currently in the hands of ossified, conceited, and self-serving authority. The long tail will help foster cognitive diversity. One highlight of the year 2006 was to find in my mailbox a draft manuscript of a book called Cognitive Diversity, How Our Individual Differences Produce Collective Benefits, by Scott Page. Page examines the effects of cognitive diversity on problem solving and shows how variability in views and methods acts like an engine for tinkering. It works like evolution. By subverting the big structures, we also get rid of the platonified one way of doing things. In the end, the bottom-up theory-free empiricist should prevail. In sum, the long tail is a byproduct of extremistan that makes it somewhat less unfair. The world is made no less unfair for the little guy, but it now becomes extremely unfair for the big man. Nobody is truly established. The little guy is very subversive. Naive globalization. We are gliding into disorder, but not necessarily bad disorder. This implies that we will see more periods of calm and stability, with most problems concentrated into a small number of black swans. Consider the nature of past wars. The 20th century was not the deadliest, in percentage of the total population, but it brought something new, the beginning of the extremistan warfare, a small probability of a conflict degenerating into total decimation of the human race, a conflict from which nobody is safe anywhere. A similar effect is taking place in economic life. I spoke about globalization in Chapter 3. It is here, but it is not all for the good. It creates interlocking fragility while reducing volatility and giving the appearance of stability. In other words, it creates devastating black swans. We have never lived before under the threat of a global collapse. Financial institutions have been merging into a smaller number of very large banks. Almost all banks are now interrelated. So the financial ecology is swelling into gigantic, incestuous, bureaucratic banks, often Gaussianized in their risk measurement. When one falls, they all fall. Footnote. As if we did not have enough problems, banks are now more vulnerable to the black swan and the ludic fallacy than ever before, with scientists among their staff taking care of exposures. The giant firm J.P. Morgan put the entire world at risk by introducing in the 90s risk metrics, a phony method aiming at managing people's risks, causing the generalized use of the ludic fallacy, and bringing Dr. Johns into power in place of the skeptical Fat Tonys, a related method called value at risk, which relies on the quantitative measurement of risk, has been spreading. Likewise, the government-sponsored institution Fannie Mae, when I look at their risks, seems to be sitting on a barrel of dynamite, vulnerable to the slightest hiccup. But not to worry. Their large staff of scientists deemed these events unlikely. The increased concentration among banks seems to have the effect of making financial crises less likely, but when they happen, they are more global in scale and hit us very hard. We have moved from a diversified ecology of small banks with varied lending policies to a more homogeneous framework of firms that all resemble one another. True, we now have fewer failures, but when they occur, I shiver at the thought. I rephrase here. We will have fewer but more severe crises. The rarer the event, the less we know about its odds. It means that we know less and less about the possibility of a crisis. And we have some idea how such a crisis would happen. A network is an assemblage of elements called nodes that are somehow connected to one another by a link. The world's airports constitute a network, as does the World Wide Web, as do social connections and electricity grids. There is a branch of research called network theory that studies the organization of such networks and the links between their nodes, with such researchers as Duncan Watts, Stephen Strogatz, Albert Laszlo Barabasi, and many more. They all understand extremistan mathematics and the inadequacy of the Gaussian bell curve. They have uncovered the following property of networks. There is a concentration among a few nodes that serve as central connections. Networks have a natural tendency to organize themselves around an extremely concentrated architecture. A few nodes are extremely connected, others barely so. The distribution of these connections has a scalable structure of the kind we will discuss in chapters 15 and 16. Concentration of this kind is not limited to the Internet. It appears in social life. A small number of people are connected to others, in electricity grids, in communications networks. This seems to make networks more robust. Random insults to most parts of the network will not be consequential, since they are likely to hit a poorly connected spot. But it also makes networks more vulnerable to black swans. Just consider what would happen if there is a problem with a major node. The electricity blackout experienced in the northeastern United States during August 2003, with its consequential mayhem, is a perfect example of what could take place if one of the big banks went under today. But banks are in a far worse situation than the Internet. The financial industry has no significant long tail. We would be far better off if there were a different ecology, in which financial institutions went bust on occasion and were rapidly replaced by new ones, thus mirroring the diversity of Internet businesses and the resilience of the Internet economy. Or if there were a long tail of government officials and civil servants coming to reinvigorate bureaucracies. Reversals away from Extremistan. There is inevitably a mounting tension between our society, full of concentration, and our classical idea of aurea mediocritas, the golden mean, so it is conceivable that efforts may be made to reverse such concentration. We live in a society of one person, one vote, where progressive taxes have been enacted precisely to weaken the winners. Indeed, the rules of society can be easily rewritten by those at the bottom of the pyramid to prevent concentration from hurting them. But it does not require voting to do so. Religion could soften the problem. Consider that before Christianity, in many societies, the powerful had many wives, thus preventing those at the bottom from accessing wombs, a condition that is not too different from the reproductive exclusivity of alpha males in many species. But Christianity reversed this, thanks to the one-man, one-woman rule. Later, Islam came to limit the number of wives to four. Judaism, which had been polygenic, became monogamous in the Middle Ages. One can say that such a strategy has been successful. The institution of tightly monogamous marriage, with no official concubine, as in the Greco-Roman days, even when practiced the French way, provides social stability since there is no pool of angry, sexually deprived men at the bottom fomenting a revolution just so they can have the chance to mate. But I find the emphasis on economic inequality, at the expense of other types of inequality, extremely bothersome. Fairness is not exclusively an economic matter. It becomes less and less so when we are satisfying our basic material needs. It is pecking order that matters. The superstars will always be there. The Soviets may have flattened the economic structure, but they encouraged their own brand of ubermensch. What is poorly understood, or denied, owing to its unsettling implications, is the absence of a role for the average in intellectual production. The disproportionate share of the very few in intellectual influence is even more unsettling than the unequal distribution of wealth. Unsettling because, unlike the income gap, no social policy can eliminate it. Communism could conceal or compress income discrepancies, but it could not eliminate the superstar system in intellectual life. It has even been shown, by Michael Marmot of the Whitehall Studies, that those at the top of the pecking order live longer, even when adjusting for disease. Marmot's impressive project shows how social rank alone can affect longevity. It was calculated that actors who win an Oscar tend to live on average about 5 years longer than their peers who don't. People live longer in societies that have flatter social gradients. Winners kill their peers as those in a steep social gradient live shorter lives, regardless of their economic condition. I do not know how to remedy this, except through religious beliefs. Is insurance against your peers' demoralizing success possible? Should the Nobel Prize be banned? Granted, the Nobel Medal in economics has not been good for society or knowledge, but even those rewarded for real contributions in medicine and physics too rapidly displace others from our consciousness and steal longevity away from them. Extremistan is here to stay, so we have to live with it and find the tricks that make it more palatable. Chapter 15. The Bell Curve. that great intellectual fraud. Footnote. The non-technical or intuitive listener can skip this chapter, as it goes into some details about the bell curve. Also, you can skip it if you belong to the category of fortunate people who do not know about the bell curve. Not worth a pastis. Quetelet's error. The average man is a monster. Let's deify it. Yes or no. Not so literary an experiment. Forget everything you heard in college statistics or probability theory. If you never took such a class, even better. Let us start from the very beginning. The Gaussian and the Mandelbrotian. I was transiting through the Frankfurt airport in December 2001, on my way from Oslo to Zurich. I had time to kill at the airport, and it was a great opportunity for me to buy dark European chocolate, especially since I have managed to successfully convince myself that airport calories don't count. The cashier handed me, among other things, a 10 Deutschmark bill. The Deutschmark banknotes were going to be put out of circulation in a matter of days, since Europe was switching to the euro. I kept it as a valedictory. Before the arrival of the euro, Europe had plenty of national currencies, which was good for printers, money changers, and, of course, currency traders like this more or less humble author. As I was eating my dark European chocolate and wistfully looking at the bill, I almost choked. I suddenly noticed, for the first time, that there was something curious about it. The bill bore the portrait of Carl Friedrich Gauss and a picture of his Gaussian bell curve. The striking irony here is that the last possible object that can be linked to the German currency is precisely such a curve. The Reichsmark, as the currency was previously called, went from 4 per dollar to 4 trillion per dollar in the space of a few years during the 1920s, an outcome that tells you that the bell curve is meaningless as a description of the randomness in currency fluctuations. All you need to reject the bell curve is for such a movement to occur once and only once. Just consider the consequences. Yet there was the bell curve, and next to it Herr Professor Dr. Gauss, unprepossessing, a little stern, certainly not someone I'd want to spend time with lounging on a terrace, drinking pastis, and holding a conversation without a subject. Shockingly, the bell curve is used as a risk measurement tool by those regulators and central bankers who wear dark suits and talk in a boring way about currencies. The increase in the decrease. The main point of the Gaussian, as I've said, is that most observations hover around the mediocre, the average. The odds of a deviation decline faster and faster, exponentially, as you move away from the average. If you must have only one single piece of information, this is the one. The dramatic increase in the speed of decline in the odds as you move away from the center, or the average. Listen to this list for an illustration of this. I am taking an example of a Gaussian quantity, such as height, and simplifying it a bit to make it more illustrative. Assume that the average height, men and women, is 1.67 meters, or 5 feet 7 inches. Consider what I call a unit of deviation here as 10 centimeters. Let us look at increments above 1.67 meters and consider the odds of someone being that tall. Footnote, I have fudged the numbers a bit for simplicity's sake. 10 centimeters taller than the average, i.e., taller than 1.77 meters, or 5 feet 10, 1 in 6.3. 20 centimeters taller than the average, i.e., taller than 1.87 meters, or 6 feet 2, 1 in 44. 30 centimeters taller than the average, i.e., taller than 1.97 meters, or 6 feet 6, 1 in 740. 40 centimeters taller than the average, i.e., taller than 2.07 meters, or 6 feet 9, 1 in 32,000. 50 centimeters taller than the average, i.e., taller than 2.17 meters, or 7 feet 1, 1 in 3,500,000. 60 centimeters taller than the average, i.e., taller than 2.27 meters, or 7 feet 5, 1 in 1 billion. 70 centimeters taller than the average, i.e. taller than 2.37 meters, or 7 feet 9, 1 in 780 billion. 80 centimeters taller than the average, i.e. taller than 2.47 meters, or 8 feet 1. 1 in 1 quadrillion, 600 trillion. 90 centimeters taller than the average, i.e. taller than 2.57 meters, or 8 feet 5. 1 in 8 quintillion, 900 quadrillion. 100 centimeters taller than the average, i.e. taller than 2.67 meters, or 8 feet 9. 1 in 130 sextillion. And 110 centimeters taller than the average, i.e. taller than 2.77 meters, or 9 feet 1. 1 in 36 octovigintillion. Note that soon after, I believe 22 deviations, or 220 centimeters taller than the average, the odds reach a Google, which is one with 100 zeros behind it. The point of this list is to illustrate the acceleration. Look at the difference in odds between 60 and 70 centimeters taller than average. For a mere increase of 4 inches, we go from 1 in 1 billion people to 1 in 780 billion. As for the jump between 70 and 80 centimeters, an additional 4 inches above the average, we go from 1 in 780 billion to 1 in 1.6 million billion. Footnote. One of the most misunderstood aspects of a Gaussian is its fragility and vulnerability in the estimation of tail events. The odds of a 4 sigma move are twice that of a 4.15 sigma. The odds of a 20 sigma are a trillion times higher than those of a 21 sigma. It means that a small measurement error of the sigma will lead to a massive underestimation of the probability. We can be a trillion times wrong about some events. This precipitous decline in the odds of encountering something is what allows you to ignore outliers. Only one curve can deliver this decline, and it is the bell curve, and its non-scalable siblings. The Mandelbrotian. By comparison, look at the odds of being rich in Europe. Assume that wealth there is scalable, i.e., Mandelbrotian. This is not an accurate description of wealth in Europe. It is simplified to emphasize the logic of scalable distribution. Footnote. My main point, which I repeat in some form or another throughout Part 3, is as follows. Everything is made easy, conceptually, when you consider that there are two, and only two, possible paradigms. Non-scalable, like the Gaussian, and other, such as Mandelbrotian randomness. The rejection of the application of the non-scalable is sufficient, as we will see later, to eliminate a certain vision of the world. This is like negative empiricism. I know a lot by determining what is wrong. Scalable wealth distribution. People with a net worth higher than 1 million euros, 1 in 62.5. Higher than 2 million euros, 1 in 250. Higher than 4 million euros, 1 in 1,000. Higher than 8 million euros, 1 in 4,000. Higher than 16 million euros, 1 in 16,000. Higher than 32 million euros, 1 in 64,000. Higher than 320 million euros, 1 in 6,400,000. The speed of the decrease here remains constant, or does not decline. When you double the amount of money, you cut the incidence by a factor of 4, no matter the level, whether you are at 8 million euros or 16 million euros. This, in a nutshell, illustrates the difference between Mediocristan and Extremistan. Recall the comparison between the scalable and the non-scalable in Chapter 3. Scalability means that there is no headwind to slow you down. Of course, Mandelbrotian Extremistan can take many shapes. Consider wealth in an extremely concentrated version of Extremistan. There, if you double the wealth, you have the incidence. The result is quantitatively different from the above example, but it obeys the same logic. Fractal wealth distribution with large inequalities. People with a net worth higher than 1 million euros, 1 in 63. Higher than 2 million euros, 1 in 125. Higher than 4 million euros, 1 in 250. Higher than 8 million euros, 1 in 500. Higher than 16 million euros, 1 in 1,000. Higher than 32 million euros, 1 in 2,000. higher than 320 million euros, 1 in 20,000. Higher than 640 million euros, 1 in 40,000. If wealth were Gaussian, we would observe the following divergence away from 1 million euros. Wealth distribution assuming a Gaussian law. People with a net worth higher than 1 million euros, 1 in 63. Higher than 2 million euros, 1 in 127,000. Higher than 3 million euros, 1 in 14 billion. Higher than 4 million euros, 1 in 886 quadrillion. Higher than 8 million euros, 1 in 16 decillion. Higher than 16 million euros, 1 in... None of my computers is capable of handling the computation. What I want to show with these lists is the qualitative difference in the paradigms. As I have said, the second paradigm is scalable. It has no headwind. Note that another term for the scalable is power laws. Just knowing that we are in a power law environment does not tell us much. Why? Because we have to measure the coefficients in real life, which is much harder than with a Gaussian framework. Only the Gaussian yields its properties rather rapidly. The method I propose is a general way of viewing the world rather than a precise solution. What to remember? Remember this. The Gaussian bell curve variations face a headwind that makes probabilities drop at a faster and faster rate as you move away from the mean, while scalables, or Mandelbrotian variations, do not have such a restriction. That's pretty much most of what you need to know. Footnote. Note that variables may not be infinitely scalable. There could be a very, very remote upper limit, but we do not know where it is, so we treat a given situation as if it were infinitely scalable. Technically, you cannot sell more of one book than there are denizens of the planet, but that upper limit is large enough to be treated as if it didn't exist. Furthermore, who knows, by repackaging the book, you might be able to sell it to a person twice, or get that person to watch the same movie several times. Inequality. Let us look more closely at the nature of inequality. In the Gaussian framework, inequality decreases as the deviations get larger, caused by the increase in the rate of decrease. Not so with the scalable. Inequality stays the same throughout. The inequality among the super-rich is the same as the inequality among the simply rich. It does not slow down. Footnote. As I was revising this draft in August 2006, I stayed at a hotel in Dedham, Massachusetts, near one of my children's summer camps. There, I was a little intrigued by the abundance of weight-challenged people walking around the lobby and causing problems with elevator backups. It turned out that the annual convention of NAFA, the National Association for Fat Acceptance, was being held there. As most of the members were extremely overweight, I was not able to figure out which delegate was the heaviest. Some form of equality prevailed among the very heavy. Someone much heavier than the persons I saw would have been dead. I am sure that at the NARA convention, the National Association for Rich Acceptance, one person would dwarf the others, and even among the super-rich, a very small percentage would represent a large section of the total wealth. Consider this effect. Take a random sample of any two people from the U.S. population who jointly earn $1 million per annum. What is the most likely breakdown of their respective incomes? In Mediocristan, the most likely combination is half a million each. In Extremistan, it would be $50,000 and $950,000. The situation is even more lopsided with book sales. If I told you that two authors sold a total of 1 million copies of their books, the most likely combination is 993,000 copies sold for one and 7,000 for the other. This is far more likely than that the books each sold 500,000 copies. For any large total, the breakdown will be more and more asymmetric. Why is this so? The height problem provides a comparison. If I told you that the total height of two people is 14 feet, you would identify the most likely breakdown as 7 feet each, not 2 feet and 12 feet, not even 8 feet and 6 feet. Persons taller than 8 feet are so rare that such a combination would be impossible. Extremistan and the 80-20 rule. Have you ever heard of the 80-20 rule? It is the common signature of a power law. Actually, it is how it all started, when Vilfredo Pareto made the observation that 80% of the land in Italy was owned by 20% of the people. Some use the rule to imply that 80% of the work is done by 20% of the people, or that 80% worth of effort contributes to only 20% of results, and vice versa. As far as axioms go, this one wasn't phrased to impress you the most. It could easily be called the 50-01 rule, that is, 50% of the work comes from 1% of the workers. This formulation makes the world look even more unfair, yet the two formulae are exactly the same. How? Well, if there is inequality, then those who constitute the 20% in the 80-20 rule also contribute unequally. Only a few of them deliver the lion's share of the results. This trickles down to about 1 in 100 contributing a little more than half the total. The 80-20 rule is only metaphorical. It is not a rule, even less a rigid law. In the U.S. book business, the proportions are more like 97-20, i.e., 97% of book sales are made by 20% of the authors. It's even worse if you focus on literary nonfiction. 20 books of close to 8,000 represent half the sales. Note here that it is not all uncertainty. In some situations, you may have a concentration of the 80-20 type with very predictable and tractable properties, which enables clear decision-making, because you can identify beforehand where the meaningful 20% are. These situations are very easy to control. For instance, Malcolm Gladwell wrote in an article in The New Yorker that most abuse of prisoners is attributable to a very small number of vicious guards. Filter those guards out and your rate of prisoner abuse drops dramatically. In publishing, on the other hand, you do not know beforehand which book will bring home the bacon. The same with wars, as you do not know beforehand which conflict will kill a portion of the planet's residents. Grass and trees. I'll summarize here and repeat the arguments previously made throughout the book. Measures of uncertainty that are based on the bell curve simply disregard the possibility and the impact of sharp jumps or discontinuities and are, therefore, inapplicable in extremistan. Using them is like focusing on the grass and missing out on the gigantic trees. Although unpredictable large deviations are rare, they cannot be dismissed as outliers because, cumulatively, their impact is so dramatic. The traditional Gaussian way of looking at the world begins by focusing on the ordinary and then deals with exceptions or so-called outliers as ancillaries. But there is a second way, which takes the exceptional as a starting point and treats the ordinary as subordinate. I have emphasized that there are two varieties of randomness, qualitatively different, like air and water. One does not care about extremes. The other is severely impacted by them. One does not generate black swans. The other does. We cannot use the same techniques to discuss a gas as we would use with a liquid. And if we could, we wouldn't call the approach an approximation. A gas does not approximate a liquid. We can make good use of the Gaussian approach in variables for which there is a rational reason for the largest not to be too far away from the average. If there is gravity pulling numbers down, or if there are physical limitations preventing very large observations, we end up in mediocristan. If there are strong forces of equilibrium bringing things back rather rapidly after conditions diverge from equilibrium, then again you can use the Gaussian approach. Otherwise, forget about it. This is why much of economics is based on the notion of equilibrium. Among other benefits, it allows you to treat economic phenomena as Gaussian. Note that I am not telling you that the mediocristan type of randomness does not allow for some extremes, but it tells you that they are so rare that they do not play a significant role in the total. The effect of such extremes is pitifully small and decreases as your population gets larger. To be a little bit more technical here, if you have an assortment of giants and dwarfs, that is, observations several orders of magnitude apart, you could still be in mediocristan. How? Assume you have a sample of 1,000 people, with a large spectrum running from the dwarf to the giant. You are likely to see many giants in your sample, not a rare occasional one. Your average will not be impacted by the occasional additional giant because some of these giants are expected to be part of your sample, and your average is likely to be high. In other words, the largest observation cannot be too far away from the average. The average will always contain both kinds, giants and dwarves, so that neither should be too rare, unless you get a mega-giant or a micro-dwarf on very rare occasion. This would be Mediocristan with a large unit of deviation. Note once again the following principle. The rarer the event, the higher the error in our estimation of its probability, even when using the Gaussian. Let me show you how the Gaussian bell curve sucks randomness out of life, which is why it is popular. We like it because it allows certainties. How? Through averaging, as I will discuss next. How coffee drinking can be safe. Recall from the Mediocristan discussion in Chapter 3 that no single observation will impact your total. This property will be more and more significant as your population increases in size. The averages will become more and more stable, to the point where all samples will look alike. I've had plenty of cups of coffee in my life. It's my principal addiction. I have never seen a cup jump 2 feet from my desk, nor has coffee spilled spontaneously on this manuscript without intervention, even in Russia. Indeed, it will take more than a mild coffee addiction to witness such an event. It would require more lifetimes than is perhaps conceivable. The odds are so small, one in so many zeros, that it would be impossible for me to write them down in my free time. Yet, physical reality makes it possible for my coffee cup to jump. Very unlikely, but possible. Particles jump around all the time. How come the coffee cup, itself composed of jumping particles, does not? The reason is, simply, that for the cup to jump would require that all of the particles jump in the same direction, and do so in lockstep several times in a row, with a compensating move of the table in the opposite direction. All several trillion particles in my coffee cup are not going to jump in the same direction. This is not going to happen in the lifetime of this universe. So I can safely put the coffee cup on the edge of my writing table and worry about more serious sources of uncertainty. The safety of my coffee cup illustrates how the randomness of the Gaussian is tameable by averaging. If my cup were one large particle, or acted as one, then its jumping would be a problem. But my cup is the sum of trillions of very small particles. Casino operators understand this well, which is why they never, if they do things right, lose money. They simply do not let one gambler make a massive bet, instead preferring to have plenty of gamblers make series of bets of limited size. Gamblers may bet a total of $20 million, but you needn't worry about the casino's health. The bets run, say, $20 on average. The casino caps the bets at a maximum that will allow the casino owners to sleep at night. So the variations in the casino's returns are going to be ridiculously small, no matter the total gambling activity. You will not see anyone leaving the casino with $1 billion in the lifetime of this universe. This is an application of the supreme law of Mediocristan. When you have plenty of gamblers, no single gambler will impact